This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. During the Vietnam War, Robert Weidman's jet went down. The Navy pilot soon found himself in enemy territory. He was captured and taken to an interrogator. We document Weidman's story and hear how he's working to preserve it for future generations.
For one Fort Collins artist, the old adage, paint what you see, has been a staple of her work.
It really started as a practical decision where I needed a model, and as a young art student, I had an available body in myself and the mirror.
We'll get a closer look at the intriguing work of Haley Hassler. We also hear how water managers are planning for shortages affecting the Colorado River, plus Howie Moshevitz reviews a movie.
But first, Paul Romer, who is the son of former Colorado Governor Roy Romer, is one of the winners of this year's Nobel Prize in Economics. That's cool. Accepting his award at a press conference in New York, he urged people listening to commit to something that's larger than yourself.
That's what helps you keep going. And that sense of belonging means that you can take satisfaction out of a career, whether or not you happen to be the one who gets a prize for it.
Romer teaches at New York University, where he founded the Stern Urbanization Project. It researches how policymakers can harness the growth of cities to create economic opportunity. Oh, and apparently Romer let that early morning phone call from the Swedish Academy go to voicemail twice.
Oh my gosh.
He says he didn't answer because he didn't recognize the number and thought it was a spam call.
Can I get that number, you know, just in case I win the Nobel Prize one day?
Hey, it could happen.
Traffic congestion is a growing problem in Colorado, and it's not just a Front Range issue. Many Western Slope areas are feeling the impacts as well. In three counties, voters are being asked to increase their property taxes to pay for mass transit upgrades. And that's on top of two statewide transportation funding questions on the November ballot. KUNC's Matt Bloom has more from Glenwood Springs.
So I'm standing here at the largest bus maintenance facility for the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority. There's maintenance workers making repairs on buses, and I'm here with Dan Blankenship, the CEO and executive director of RFTA.
When this facility was constructed in 2002, it was designed to stage and maintain comfortably about 30 buses, and right now that number is at 45. So we're about 150% of the capacity of the facility.
And that's just one part of the problem. He says growing ridership and increasing traffic congestion have bogged down the Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, or RAFTA, for years.
Based on the 60% population growth over the next 20 or so years in the Garfield County area, we will not have the ability to add more buses and provide more service unless we can expand this facility.
We provide commuter and city bus services to mountain communities, including Aspen, Glenwood Springs.
RAFTA logged about 5 million passenger trips last year, making it the second largest public transit system in the state. But its budget is limited to revenue collected from a regional sales tax passed in the 1990s. Ballot question 7A will ask voters in Garfield, Pitkin, and Eagle counties to approve a new 2.65 mil property tax. It's part of a massive plan called Destination 2040. It would help pay for increased bus service during peak seasons, new buses, and upgrading RAFTA's maintenance facilities.
I have not tried to figure it out in terms of how many lattes is it.
Jackie Witsit is the mayor of Basalt and on RAFTA's board of directors.
But it's in terms of lattes.
She says the average homeowner in the Roaring Fork Valley would end up paying an additional $7 a month on a $500,000 home.
We have allowed so much growth to occur here that we have to say yes to transit. We have to say yes to all those things that we have put on ourselves because we keep allowing more and more growth.
There's just no way that we can absorb that.
That's Larry Bowinger. He lives in nearby Carbondale with his wife. He spoke out about the plan at a public meeting in August.
Our family does not utilize RAFTA's facilities. We don't hike or bike the Rio Grande Trail. We're retired. We're on a fixed income. So we're opposed to any type of a tax increase.
But supporters say it's a small price to pay. At a bus stop in Glenwood Springs, I met Chrissy Strom. She's voting for 7A because her 77-year-old father relies on the bus to get around.
So I think it's important that while you may not use the bus on a daily or even monthly basis, there are people that rely on it either for an economic value or personal value that really sustains the level of community that is kind of unmatchable to any other community.
Watch how tight this is.
Back at the RAFTA maintenance facility, Dan Blankenship shows me one of the occupational hazards they face inside their cramped space.
And now the drivers, to get to their buses, they have to walk between these, and sometimes there may be a driver that's inspecting their bus in here. Another one has done his inspection, and then they're pulling out, and this driver might be backing up and might get hit with a ski rack. There might be something protruding that they could hit by, or they could get their foot run over.
Supporters of 7A say there could be dire consequences for the RAFTA system if the ballot question is not passed, including the loss of existing bus routes. It's a risk voters will have to take into account when wading through an already packed ballot with competing statewide questions for transportation funding. Matt Bloom, KUNC, Glenwood Springs.
Americans who were held prisoner during the Vietnam War recently hit a milestone, the 45th anniversary of their return home. Since then, about a third of these POWs have passed away. Many are now in their 70s. KUNC's Michael DeJoanna spoke with one who lives in Fort Collins about how he is preserving his story.
Robert Weidman and I are sitting at the desk in his office. I'm showing him grainy film footage on his laptop. It's just images, no sound. He adjusts his glasses and runs his hand over his gray hair.
I've never seen this. Never.
It's March 4th, 1973. That's the day Weidman and dozens of other prisoners of war were released in Hanoi. They're lined up in two neat rows, dressed in the same gray jackets, black trousers, and
everybody got a haircut.
Soldiers with the North Vietnamese Army watch as each former prisoner walks up to a smiling American officer. They salute, shake hands, and each gets a friendly pat on the back.
There's me.
This footage would have been lost if a military museum in Maine hadn't rescued it from the trash and posted it online.
How did you feel right then?
I was just at that point, I'm waiting to get on the plane and waiting for the wheels to come up. Because they could have called that off at any time.
Navy Lieutenant Robert Weidman was one of 662 American prisoners that came home from Vietnam. That's according to the nonprofit NAM POWs. The organization estimates that just 451 of them are still alive.
A lot of guys, especially the Army guys, have just blended into society and have disappeared. And we can't find them. We call those guys lost sheep.
Mike McGrath is a historian for NAM POWs. He's also a former Navy pilot and POW himself. He lives in Monument, Colorado, and helps organize gatherings for the group.
They're getting smaller because we're dying off. But most of the guys who are regular attendees still attend.
Including, at least recently, Robert Weidman, who also wrote a book about his experiences in Vietnam. Unexpected Prisoner recounts his nearly 6 years in captivity, including time at the famed Hanoi Hilton, where Senator John McCain, who passed away this summer, was held. On May 6, 1967, the skies over northern Vietnam were clear. That afternoon, Weidman found himself tumbling through the air.
And I can see between my feet, you know, the blue sky and the ground and the sky and the ground.
The control stick in his A-4 Skyhawk jet had jammed, and he couldn't stop it from going down. So he launched the ejection seat.
And then all of a sudden, the parachute just opened up. And I looked out at the coast about 2 miles away, and I thought about my wife and my brother and my family. And then I made a couple transmissions. You know, Raven Lee, this is two, how do you read? I got no response. Then about that time, I heard a whistling sound of a bullet going by me.
He hit the ground with two broken fingers and a messed up shoulder. An enemy soldier was standing just 25 yards away.
He's just waiting to see what I'm going to do. I just turned my palms of my hands up, and then he dropped his hands, and all these people charged me. They all had knives, and they cut me out of everything. They had me down to my underwear in about 30 seconds.
Weidman was then whisked away to a nearby hut.
They sit me down, blindfold me, tie my hands behind my back, and we just waited. And the rescue planes came in, and there was a war going on for about 45 minutes.
But there was no rescue. Soon he was struggling to stay on his feet while marching through rice paddies and hostile villages to a truck that brought him to a dark room where an interrogator was waiting.
And he says, "What city are you from?" I says, "I can't answer that question." He says, "Well, if you don't answer, I'm going to have my guards take you out and shoot you." And he asked me again. I says, "I'd really like to answer your question, but my government won't let me answer."
The ropes around his arms were cinched so tightly that it felt like they were barbed wire cutting to the bone. His arms turned purple, and he started convulsing. He shouted that he'd never talk. And then, he gave in.
He says, "What city are you from?" I says, "Cleveland, Ohio." He says, "Okay, Robert. They like to call me Robert. Now you may go to sleep." So they hog-tied me to that 2x4, and I went to sleep.
It was just the beginning of his torture. Eventually, he wound up in a small windowless room in Hanoi with a few other POWs.
No books, no games, no nothing. It was just boring. I mean, I counted squares on the ceiling.
His fellow POWs kept him company, but the conversation became routine. Months dragged on, but with them came the possibility for change. In 1968, following the Tet Offensive attacks on the U.S., President Lyndon Johnson began to outline a path to peace.
"We are reducing, substantially reducing, the present level of hostilities."
In December of that year, Weidman received something that raised his hopes, a package from home with a bar of French milled soap and photos, including of his wife, Patricia, who he said looked gorgeous, and one of his brother, who also fought in Vietnam.
He had those big pork chop sideburns, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mutton chops.
Mutton chops, yeah. But I was just so glad he was still alive.
1969 brought more hope. Though there was still torture, conditions were slowly improving for a few reasons, including the passing of North Vietnam's leader, Ho Chi Minh. And in the U.S., POW families drew attention to their loved ones. By mid-1970, Weidman and others had moved to a new location in Hanoi.
We had big windows, and we were getting out twice a day for 2 or 3 hours at a time. We're getting 2 baths a day.
There was hope that they'd go home soon, but it turned out they'd be held for 3 more years.
"I have asked for this radio and television time tonight."
Then, on January 23rd, 1973, President Richard Nixon announced the Paris Peace Accords.
"Within 60 days from this Saturday, all Americans held prisoners of war throughout Indochina will be released."
And that brings us back to the footage that we're watching on the laptop from that year, the film of a young, thin, smiling Robert Weidman getting his wish.
Boy, the freaking plane took off, and when the wheels came in, I just started crying. You know, this freaking ordeal is over.
Weidman left the Navy in 1983 as a lieutenant commander. Like many who served in the war, his marriage ended in divorce. Through the years, he says he struggled emotionally. When he finally went to a Veterans Affairs clinic, he was told the same thing as 30% of his fellow Vietnam-era vets.
"Oh, you got post-traumatic stress."
All these years later, he says little things can still set him off. But some things help, like Bible studies and this.
Wow.
His 6 grandkids. After working in business, in law, and then as a flight simulator instructor, Weidman fully retired in 2012, leaving his home in Mississippi for Fort Collins. Luckily for him, all his grandchildren live in the area, and several are at this soccer park with their parents. I asked one of them, 8-year-old Max, to tell me about his granddad.
He was in the Civil War.
How does that feel, Robert?
Perfect answer.
The Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War, and he's cool.
Michael DeOanna, KUNC.
We have a lot more great stuff to get to in this episode, including how water managers along the Colorado River are dealing with pressure, both from climate change and the federal government.
If you're talking about water for 40 million people and economies that are massive, fifth largest economy in the world that the Colorado River Basin represents, then that's significant.
We'll get a closer look at the drought contingency plans in the works and how he reviews a new version of a Hollywood classic, A Star is Born. But before we get to that, we just want to remind you that we are a public radio station.
That's right. We rely on listeners who make financial contributions to support the work of the KUNC Newsroom and, by extension, this weekly podcast. We are in our fall membership drive right now, so if you're already a member, thank you. If you're not, we invite you to donate now at KUNC.org. Many listeners give $10 or $20 or $25 a month, but whatever amount feels right to you is just fine with us. And thank you so much for supporting our work.
After years of drought, the Colorado River is in trouble. Water levels have been dropping in Lake Mead and Lake Powell to the point where officials are now working on plans to get by with less water. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more on the negotiations and what's at stake.
Jennifer Pitt is looking out onto Lake Powell in northern Arizona. We're on an overlook, peering down on the country's second largest reservoir. It's full of tourists taking selfies.
No, you can tell that there's a river here underneath this reservoir because it has somewhat of a linear shape.
Pitt works on Colorado River policy for the National Audubon Society.
And it's wending its way towards where we're standing here, overlooking the Glen Canyon Dam.
The Red Rock Canyon behind the dam is stained with a stark white ring. For the past 20 years, Pitt says, demands for water have outstripped the supply, meaning Lake Powell and its sister reservoir, Lake Mead, continue to drop. Pitt says without changes to how they're managed, they could plummet to levels where no water can be released.
And if that happened, that would be a catastrophe for this region's economy, for all of the people who depend on the Colorado River, and for all of the wildlife that depends on it as well.
More is being taken out than comes into it, like your bank account. If you do that over a sustained period, you will run a deficit.
That's James Eklund. He's the Colorado representative on an interstate commission that oversees the river.
And if you're talking about water for 40 million people and economies that are massive, fifth largest economy in the world that the Colorado River Basin represents, then that's significant.
Which is why Eklund and other water managers have been working on so-called drought contingency plans, though a more apt title would probably replace drought with climate change. Their premise is simple. Cut water use now to avoid a huge problem in the future, when supplies are likely to be even tighter. Eric Kuhn is the former manager of the Colorado River District.
There's clearly enough evidence that if we were to have another 2000 to 2004 kind of, you know, multi-year drought, the system is in very serious trouble.
Back in 2007, when the current guidelines for river management were written, he says people were feeling optimistic.
Historically, we've always said, well, next year would be better, and that's the easy way out.
But most of that optimism is gone. Kuhn says Arizona has had the hardest time coming to an agreement, but states in the river's upper basin, like Colorado, have had issues too. For example, this thing called demand management.
It's the difficult one. It's somebody's going to have to use less.
And in the process of using less water, Kuhn says, there's a fear that if those cuts aren't doled out fairly, it could injure economies throughout the Southwest.
The thing we have to remember is the basin is over 80% agriculture, 75 to 80% on any given year.
Colby Pellegrino is with the Southern Nevada Water Authority, the Las Vegas metro area's water utility. She says current conservation programs, like their aggressive buyback of residential lawns, won't be enough to avoid a crisis.
So we can take out all the lawns we want and still not solve the problems that climate change is going to throw at us.
Back at Glen Canyon Dam, the National Audubon Society's Jennifer Pitt says it's more than just the fates of people that hang in the balance. It's an entire ecosystem.
I think a lot of people who care about wildlife in this region are concerned. And it's not just birds. You know, 70% of all wildlife in the arid West rely on rivers at some point in their life cycle. So it has outsized importance for anyone who appreciates nature in this part of the country.
Climate change is one factor to get these deals done quickly. Another, the federal government. Officials with the U.S. Department of the Interior have given states an end-of-year deadline to get things done. If not, the assumption is the feds will step in and do it for them. I'm Luke Runyon.
For For painters throughout history, the portrait has been a staple of their repertoire. The style is a way of capturing a moment in time, the subject, their muse. But one Fort Collins artist is taking a different look at both. KUNC arts reporter Stacy Nick has more.
Hey.
Hi. I'm sorry.
This isn't the first time I've met painter Haley Hassler, but if this encounter at her new exhibit at Fort Collins' Museum of Art was our first, I wouldn't need an introduction. Each of the show's more than 20 portraits sports a familiar face.
My work might start with just a little idea, like I'm going to have the female character, and I don't think of it as me, I do think of it as just a female character.
But Hassler is that character, along with a revolving cast that includes her husband, three children, and even some of their pets. Over the last 15 years, the self-portrait has become a hallmark of her work.
It really started as a practical decision where I needed a model, and as a young art student, I had an available body in myself and the mirror.
As we walk through the quiet, still-closed museum, it becomes clear that the paintings, many of which were inspired by iconic works from the great masters, are a reflection of Hassler's love for art history, as well as her frustration with it.
That goes back to the idea that women haven't told their story enough in history. Women have not had the opportunity to have their voices heard so much before as we do now. And it turns out those stories are different, and they need to be told. And how can I tell it from any other point of view but my own? And it'll be nice when one day we don't have to say this is the woman's point of view, this is a human point of view, instead of it being the default male point of view.
For Hassler, the most intriguing images are those of a mother and child.
So this one is called Mother and Child with Snakes and Ribbons. And it is a very new painting. It's the most recent of the paintings in the show.
It's so new, in fact, that it's still a work in progress. The inspiration came from Caravaggio's Madonna and Child with St. Anne.
And it's quite a startling image of the mother holding her naked child, who's probably a toddler, and the two of them are putting their feet on the head of a really frightening-looking serpent.
For Hassler, it's a reflection of a mother teaching her child about the evil in the world, but also the dangers of life and childhood. In the painting, her son is playing with the snake, albeit a rubber one. To create these characters, Hassler uses a display mannequin that she dresses in elaborate costumes and surrounds with still-life props in her studio. A full-length mirror allows her to paint herself into the picture. For her children, she relies on photos. The kids have pretty much come to expect that they will appear in mom's works.
And I think they just think this is what moms do.
Many of the works feature Hassler with an ambivalent look on her face, as she does in her painting based on Tintoretto's Origin of the Milky Way.
Zeus is holding up the baby Hercules to the goddess Juno, and she's actually unwilling to nurse him, but he is kind of forcing this child on her breast because he would like the child to be a god.
Here, she's nursing her youngest son while two other babies fly through the air around her. Just past her shoulder, her husband awaits with yet another baby. Milk sprays out like pearls.
In the original painting, it's so powerful it is going to turn a baby into a god. And we do have this kind of mystical feeling about breast milk today. It's so important and also kind of scary. And we've had these battles about women nursing in public and such strong feelings about breasts and nursing and babies. And then here I am doing it and feeling like my life kind of revolves around it.
While the characters in the portraits are characters, the story that they tell is still Hassler's. Nowhere is that more obvious than in Portrait with Young Hens. It's in stark contrast to most of her work. It's just Hassler, standing with her breasts and 9-month pregnant belly exposed, holding two baby chickens.
I was tired when I made that painting. I was close to having the child, and it has a less finished surface than many of my paintings. I had to just finish it in that time period. I knew it wasn't going to last much longer, and I couldn't stand on my feet for too many hours, and yet I really wanted to have this last chance to paint my body in that state, which is, it's just fascinating to have your body, especially if you're a self-portrait figure painter, to have your own body become such a different body.
As her children get older, Haley Hassler is exploring other elements of life. But she says she often still comes back to motherhood.
Those things will all come into the paintings. I just can't help it. They just pop in. What I tend to be thinking about and stewing over comes into the work.
And she's good with that. There haven't been enough women's stories in art, she says, at least not from the first-person perspective. Stacey Nick, KUNC.
In A Star is Born, a famous singer discovers a young, talented woman whom he takes under his wing and then some. It's directed by Bradley Cooper, who also stars in the movie. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says this old warhorse of a story may have seen better days.
It doesn't take long for the star to get herself born in this latest, now the fourth version of a story that first hit the movies in 1937. There also isn't much struggle to get to that stardom. Allie, Lady Gaga, has a couple of slightly annoying moments with the boss at her restaurant job, and then bingo, she's on stage with country rocker Jackson Maine, Bradley Cooper, in front of thousands of cheering fans. It would be nice if Allie had to work for her celebrity for at least a few minutes. You might call the film A Star is Born Light. The script for the 1937 film was written by Dorothy Parker, who was capable of sarcasm and irony. The film came out during the Great Depression, and it's about an actress, Janet Gaynor, not a singer. She works plenty hard to escape her small-town upbringing, make it in Hollywood, and survive the alcoholic husband. Luckily, she has a feisty grandmother to pull her out of her down times. She also feels significant grief over her husband's death. For the 1954 version, a post-war movie, Judy Garland radiates a depth of personal angst that brought a level of worry and anxiety to every film she made, and her co-star James Mason is no ray of golden sun either. I've always thought of the 1976 film with Barbara Streisand as a joke. It reeks of Streisand's on-screen vanity, and she so dominates the screen's sweet spot that poor Kris Kristofferson looks like an orphan left out in the rain. That film was produced by John Peters, Streisand's hairdresser, who changed careers to do the film. He also gets his name all alone on screen as producer for this movie. The latest A Star is Born isn't a bad film. It's pleasant, which is not really a compliment. And it has good singing along with Bradley Cooper's blue eyes and comfortably predictable direction. But the picture's sterile. As the fourth go-round of the story, it could use irony and wit instead of bland sincerity. When Jack earnestly tells Allie to maintain her integrity as stardom advances, he says she must keep singing her truth. But Allie's songs are really piles of empty adolescent clichés about gushy love. There's no great truth to defend. It makes sense now to have a film about celebrity, especially when it happens fast. That describes our world pretty well, and so does the film's level of intoxication. The world is drugged and drunked up. And we are full up on people of little note or talent getting famous fast and disappearing just as quickly as they rise. But if someone really wants to make that film, it probably shouldn't go down so easily as this telling of A Star is Born. There's not much cost to pay here, and when Jack Maine finally decides to end his life, the movie turns away, as it does at every possibly tough moment. The first two films show Maine's life progressively falling apart. The two men are out-of-control alcoholics, but it still takes a lot to push them to despair. Bradley Cooper's Jack Maine rolls over on cue. It seems to me there's another question about every version of A Star is Born. All four pictures showcase established movie stars, performers at the top of their game. Maybe the women characters are nobodies when they enter the film, but the audience knows long before the theater lights go down that the actors who play them are the biggest stars in the business. There's a disconnect when characters played by Lady Gaga or Barbara Streisand or Judy Garland are elevated to stardom. It's no surprise that these protégés are great singers. But when times are upsetting, confirming the obvious can be reassuring. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. Thank you. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard Graze from Evan Schaefer, Broke for Free with their song Note Drop, Blue Dot Sessions with Volantis.
Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, and Pipe Choir with Almost Time. Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you never miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.